England Public Radio News. I'm Adam Frenier, and this is the shortlist, NEPR's Week in Review. And with us today, Rick Hurst, publisher of the African American Point of View, and on the line, Chris Collins, columnist with the Greenfield Recorder. Welcome to you both.
Good to be here.
Good to be here as well.
This week, the future shape of the Western Massachusetts delegation in the state legislature continued to change. Democratic State Representative Peter Cocott of Northampton died after an illness at the age of 61. And State Rep Solomon Goldstein Rose of Amherst said this week he's leaving the Democratic Party to become an independent, or unenrolled as it's known in Massachusetts. This comes on top of the announced retirements of veteran reps John Sybak and Steve Kulik. Chris, let's start with Cocott. His colleagues remembered him as a thoughtful lawmaker and a gentle giant given his large physical stature. What do you remember about him?
I remember that as well. I was able to interview him many times when I was working in the Northampton market, and he was never one that was really willing, I'd say unwilling, but certainly was not wild about being interviewed. He was much more of a behind-the-scenes guy, and a gentle giant is a perfect way to sort of describe Peter Cocott, an outstanding legislator, fully understood that the job of anybody in that position is to represent the people, not necessarily to feather your own political nest. And he was a master, and he rose very, very quickly, and is a huge loss. I mean, as big a loss as Kulik and Sybak are, this one in some ways is bigger because nobody really expected this, and I'm not sure there's a natural successor to that job.
Meanwhile, Rick, on the other side of the Connecticut River in Amherst, the 24-year-old Goldstein Rose, who dropped out of the Democratic Party, it looks like he opened himself up to a contested election as the runner-up from the last Democratic primary in 2016. Eric Nakajima says he plans to run against him. Goldstein Rose says he's not worried at all about the possibility of being booted out of legislative committees as a result of leaving the Democrats. What do you think about all of this?
I think it's good that he's 24 years old and not 44 or 54. I think he's taking a big risk. It's a young man's risk, and I think he can recover from it if he misses. I do think that he may not be as sensitive as he should be to the power of the Democratic Party. People tend to vote on party lines, even though independents are in the majority in the state. On the positive side, I think that the trend in the whole country is toward independent. I myself am a Democrat. I've served like a year as a Republican and got the heck out of there. But I consider myself really an independent in terms of how I vote. And I think he is, I think he's in line with popular sentiment. I just think that we're habitual kind of people. And I don't think he's going to be able to survive the party line vote.
At the very least, there's going to be at least three new reps from the region headed to Beacon Hill next year. Fresh faces, but much less seniority. Chris, we'll start with you. What's this going to mean for the region, and in particular, the middle of it in Hampshire County?
Well, I think you have to look at the demographics of that particular district, and I think that Rick is right. It's heavily Democratic. He came out of a crowded Democratic field. But I personally, as someone who is an unenrolled centrist, I love this because I think that the farther we can get away from the ideological entrenchment and the party line stuff and move more toward compromise and what's best for everybody, I think that creates a stronger commonwealth. Be that as it may, we've got a real problem in terms of seniority now. You're losing, you've lost one to death and two to retirement. Plus, Dan Rosenberg's stature is not quite what it was because of the recent scandal. So there's going to be some work to be done to restore and reestablish Western Mass's prominence.
More than 30 Massachusetts communities are suing the manufacturers and distributors of opioids. They're seeking compensation for costs stemming from the opioid crisis and funding for future recovery efforts. Attorney Peter Merrigan represents these cities and towns.
The suit against the manufacturers arises out of their misrepresentation of the addictiveness of opioids, and the suit against the distributors arises from their failure to follow federal law, namely the Controlled Substances Act, and their duty and obligation to report suspicious orders.
Rick, given your legal background, what do you think about this strategy? Is this a suit that can be won?
I think it's a suit that could be won. What surprises me that it's taken so long for somebody to bring the suit. There is no question if you followed this situation with opioids. There's no way that they would have been distributed so widespread without the assistance of the manufacturer and the distributors. These drugs have been pushed on people. And in both cases, where the manufacturer misrepresented and the distributors just broke the law outright. So I think it's a great thing. I think that's going to be the best move towards stopping the opioid crisis.
Chris, what do you think?
Well, I think Rick is right, certainly on the legal end. I wonder how culpable the physicians are that have administered these drugs. I mean, that's the only concern I have is, you know, you got some good doctors out there who tried to use these drugs in a way to help ease the pain of their patients. Are they going to get dragged into this? I mean, it kind of reminds me of the idea of suing tobacco manufacturers for, you know, damages, health damages caused by cigarettes. I think that while it may be timely and hopefully it works for the towns that have joined the suit, I think it may be tough to get a conviction or to get any kind of a judgment, but we'll see.
Finally, this week, spring training baseball games have begun in Florida and Arizona. And Rick, you recently wrote about your visits with the Red Sox president and CEO Sam Kennedy. You've long been critical of the Sox, given the racism of longtime owner Tom Yawkey. What can you tell us about your meetings with some of the top brass at Fenway Park?
Well, what I can tell you is that even though I've been critical of the history of the Sox, the current ownership and the current management has really turned that whole thing around. One of the things they did some time ago is they gave an award to Jackie Robinson. They supported a congressional medal for Jackie Robinson. I was there at the Capitol when they had the ceremony, and Luchino and all the guys were there. Now they're fighting to turn Yawkey Way away from Yawkey Way. Yawkey was quite a racist that some people don't agree, but I've done some research to suggest he was quite the racist. He turned down Jackie Robinson and Willie Mays, two of the greatest baseball players of all time. When Henry came on board and bought the Sox, he decided to turn that whole thing around. He brought on people who shared his sentiment. And all I can tell you is Sam Kennedy, who is the CEO and president, is among the best of those people. His father walked with Martin Luther King, and much of what his father believes has rubbed off on Sam, and I intend to work with him as much as I can.
And that's all the time we have this week on The Shortlist. Rick Hurst of the African-American Point of View and Chris Collins with the Greenfield Recorder, thank you so much for joining us today.
You're more than welcome.
Always a pleasure.
And thank you, our loyal listeners of The Shortlist, NEPR's Week in Review. And remember, you can catch us at any time wherever you get your podcasts or at nepr.net/podcast. I'm Adam Frenier, and this is New England Public Radio.